If I could have your attention, we'll go ahead and get started with our program this morning. Welcome to Friday of the month. Welcome to the First Friday Breakfast Club, an association of gay, bisexual, and transgendered men, and the largest private breakfast club in the state of Iowa, perhaps in surrounding states for that matter. I haven't researched the surrounding states part. We've been going strong now for over a quarter of a century. I'm Jonathan Wilson, fairly longtime member of FFBC, and really pleased to have all of you here this morning. I'm standing in for the FFBC president, Byron Huff, and our vice president, Brian Crane, was unavailable, so I'm standing in. I've heard it said that once you learn to ride a bicycle, you never forget. But apparently that isn't true. Byron was injured in a bicycle accident. As near as I can tell, no one else was involved in the accident. So the bad news was I couldn't find somebody to sue on his behalf. At any rate, he is on the mend and he's doing well and he is expected to make a full recovery. So you don't need to waste a lot of sympathy on Byron. I particularly want to thank John Schmaker for opening his home for our party in July. John, it was a tremendous time. It's one of the most spectacular venues in central Iowa, and we've been able to have our party there several times, and we really appreciate it, John. Thank you. Yes, and I had asked that it be stocked with beer when I picked it up, but apparently not, right? Okay. It is our tradition to invite those who are here for the first time to stand up and just say who they are. If there are those who are here for the first time, you're welcome to do that. This is your opportunity. Not required, but you're welcome to do that. Great. Anyone else? Okay, well, I know that there are one or two other people who are here for the first time, at least as far as I'm aware. So those of you who are regulars, if you will look around and if you see an unfamiliar face, why, be sure to make them feel welcome. And you don't have to be a gay man to attend, so if you have friends who are allies, you're welcome to invite them. I'm a gay man today only because my psychiatrist, who is in the room right now, was not able to talk me out of it at the time. Nice try, though, but didn't work. FFBC is a 501c3 entity, so contributions are tax deductible. In the time of our existence, we've been raising money for scholarships, and that's the real strength of our program. Is that scholarship fund. We've raised over $475,000 for scholarships. This last June, we gave 12 scholarships of $3,000 apiece. And we had more applicants this year than we have ever had before. The real strength of that program, however, is not in the scholarship money that goes to the student. That's worthy. Not in the encouragement that may give to other students to do courageous things around the issue of LGBT. The real strength is the ticket that it buys for us to send a representative to the high school graduation and present the scholarship there in front of an audience that may well think they've never seen a real live gay person before. And we have had some heartwarming stories come back from those experiences. Standing ovations in Podunk Center, Iowa is something you just wouldn't expect, and yet it has happened. And there are countless other stories that I could relate. When you have time to waste, I'll be glad to tell you more of them. Now through next April, we're collecting contributions for our scholarship program for the coming year. And we don't just save up the money. We give away in scholarships the money that we receive to some remarkably outstanding young people who have done really courageous things in their schools and community to reduce homophobia and to teach about LGBTQ issues. We send an email about our meetings and also with our newsletter. So if you are not receiving those notifications, it's because we don't have your email or an accurate email for you. So if you'll get us your email address, you will then receive convenient reminders of our meetings, the opportunity to RSVP so we have an accurate head count, and you will also receive our monthly newsletter. And on that score, I want to remind those who are regulars that our next copy deadline for the newsletter is August 22nd. And for anyone else who has something on your mind, or you've had an interesting experience, or you've been on a vacation, write about it, and we'll get it into the newsletter, and we'd be happy to include it in the newsletter. You can get it to me, or if you have his email address, to Wade Peterson, either one, and we'll see that it gets in the newsletter. Now, Byron prepared a script for me, which was nice, and he wanted me to encourage all of you to follow FFBC on Facebook and YouTube. Now, I, for one, don't have any idea what he's talking about, but I'm assuming that some of the rest of you will know what that means, and that will increase our social media outreach. I have a few announcements to make. Member John Clayton, who owns Broadview Garden Events, is hosting a Gay Men to Walk the Gardens on August the 20th and again on September the 24th from 2 to 6 p.m. You can contact him at, well, I'm not going to tell you that. Contact me if you want his contact information. That's easier because none of you have a piece of paper and pencil out to write this down anyway. So rattling off his email address wouldn't be particularly helpful. Also, One Iowa is hosting an LGBTQ older adults conference. Most of us in the room would qualify. That's on August the 19th. And you can go to oneiowa.org. For more details about location, time, and content. The next board of directors meeting is next Tuesday at 6:30. Any member is welcome to attend our board meetings and just let me know, or Byron, or Ryan Crane, or frankly, any member of our board of directors know, and you'll get information about location and time and that kind of thing. And now I will turn to Wade Peterson, who is going to introduce our speaker of the morning. Wade.
Thank you, Jonathan. Yes, my name is Wade Peterson. I am an FFBC board member and the newsletter editor, so I get to kind of communicate with all of you each month. One of the things that I love most about FFBC is really the opportunity to not just have a great breakfast and to kind of socialize with people, but I love listening to speakers each month. And as a retired teacher now, I always talk to my students about being lifelong learners. And I know every time that I come to FFBC, whoever the speaker is from whatever field, I'm going to walk out of here knowing something I didn't before. And I always appreciate that. So this morning I get to introduce Jerry Hatfield. A little bit about his background. He got his bachelor's in agronomy from Kansas State. He got his master's in agronomy from the University of Kentucky. And then at that point, with all that accumulated knowledge, I guess he got really smart, because for his PhD, he came back to Iowa State University for that. So he got a true cyclone in the crowd here. So the PhD was in agricultural climatology. Very impressive. And I wanted to see what other dirt I could dig up on a person like that. Sorry. So after some work in California and Texas, his life brought him back to Ames. where he spent the majority of his time. He is now the retired director of the USDA, the National Lab for Agriculture and Environment. In his time, a lot of things in his background. He's an author. He is an editor of a couple national publications. He has also been inducted into the Hall of Fame for the USDA, the ARS there. So it's pretty impressive that way. Reading through his bio, I see a lot of his research centered on the basics of the soil, the plant, the atmosphere. And that's probably where his focus on the climatology came into play as well. So working with farmers and producers, how all of those can affect the soil, the production on farms in our economy here in Iowa, a lot of interesting things that I know he'll be able to share with us. So if you would, without further ado, please help me welcome a man who is truly outstanding in his field, Jerry Hatfield.
Thanks, Wade. It is a it's a pleasure to be here and to basically talk about my lifelong passion in terms of understanding agricultural climatology, impacts of climate change, and I put a little subtitle on there because now you finished breakfast, and I'm going to tell you what threatens your next breakfast. So, Jonathan, you know, the week isn't over, so I'll give this doomsday talk for you in terms of how bad things are going to look into the future. So, you know, if we look at all of this, it really becomes important as we begin to understand this. Let's go to the next one. If we look at this, I want to give you some definitions because everybody seems to be confused at times. What's the difference between climate and weather and everything? So climate, I explain this way, and climate is basically where we get to grow a crop. I mean, obviously, we don't grow bananas in Iowa and everything else. We grow a lot of other things. But weather is really determines how much of that crop we produce. So it's the within season variability. Climate determines just geographically where we can put different crops. And then agroclimatology is the ability to be able to match crops with that given climate. And we do a lot of this. And I'll give you some examples of this that I think will hit into that piece as well. So let's go to the next one. I just look at crop production across the United States. corn, soybeans, wheat, alfalfa. We live in the Corn Belt. Every time we drive across the Midwest, my wife just completely says, you know, is there anything to see other than corn and soybeans? And no, dear, there's nothing to see other than corn and soybeans. We went clear to Kalamazoo last week for another meeting, and she goes, because we were through Illinois, and she says, you know, it just looks like Iowa. Well, you know, it is the Corn Belt. So we look at all this. There have been some really interesting changes in the past few years in the Corn Belt is because we've moved corn and soybeans into North Dakota and South Dakota. You see those really green areas up in there. Winter wheat belt, where a lot of our wheat comes from, has pretty much remained stable across the Midwestern or the Great Plains. Obviously, we get wheat out of the Northeast or Northwest in terms of some of the Durhams. Some of the bread wheats are in that area. And so you look at all this, and I mean, we spend a lot of time, but that's just gives you an idea that we do have the capability of looking at how things change, both in the U.S. as around the world. Let's go to the next one. But I want to give you some examples. The reason I'm going to give you these examples is because they really hit everybody. We have a lot of impact on wine. That's the grape piece. We have a lot of impact with climate change on coffee. We have a lot of climate change impacts on cocoa. I tell people that the three vices that people are interested in, coffee, cocoa, and wine, are threatened by climate change. And my God, now we're really talking is about a serious problem, you know, and so... But you realize that bourbon we can continue to make because we have plenty of corn. So, you know, that's not as fragile as some of the rest of this. And then I want to give you an example on cherries as well. because we have spent a lot of time on, and there was a recent article on, in 60 Minutes talking about the wine industry and how it's shaping around the world and everything else. One of my claims to fame, that doesn't show up in the resume is we actually worked in the Napa Valley and re-appellationed the Napa Valley. Appellations determine the microclimates where you put different grapes across that. The current appellations are a result of some of the things we did in the early 70s and saying that the microclimates had shifted in the Napa Valley from where they were in the early part of the 1900s till later. And so the current appellations are a result of some of the things we did. And I've spent a lot of time with the cocoa industry because that is actually being impacted by how we're shifting precipitation patterns and some of the things that are influencing where we're putting cocoa plantations around this. And I'll give you an example on cherries and go to the next slide on this, because the things that cherries require is they actually require a large amount of cooling during the winter. We always think about how things grow relative to heat, but a lot of our fruit trees require cooling during the winter. They've got to go below about 42 degrees, something like that. They're going to be exposed to temperatures below this before they'll flower in the spring. Analysis was done across the Central Valley of California, which is where a lot of the cherries are growing. And if you look at that green area and then progressing across the map, you see that there's been a continual decline in the amount of chilling hours that exist in the Central Valley. Well, the reason I use cherries as an example is cherries have some of the highest thresholds. They have over 1,200 hours of exposure before they'll flower in the next spring. So what we're seeing is in a lot of cases that cherry orchards that exist in the Central Valley are limited now in their production because they don't satisfy the chilling requirements. You also have to realize that in cherry production, we're talking about a life of an orchard that may be in the order of 30, 40 years. It takes 5 to 6 years before you can really return a profit from that plantation or that orchard as well. And the other piece is it takes about 30 to 40 years to breed a new crop of a perennial crop. So we're not talking about hybrid corn we crank out pretty rapidly. We're talking about some of the tree crops. We're talking about a 30 to 40 year effort in terms of getting something that may be requiring less chilling hours. So a lot of our perennial crops are probably more sensitive to some of the things we're going on in climate than some of the grain crops that we talk about. So that's why I use cherries as an example in there, because I do think that becomes important. You see this, all the different things that are going on. And so we often don't think about, as everybody says, well, it's in global warming and, you know, but this is a chilling piece of this. So it's the opposite end of the spectrum that we talk about. Let's go to the next one. So here's our changing climate. I got to start off and saying, I'm going to dispel some myths, maybe reinforce some myths, but tell you that here's what's changing in our climate and out there. So let's go to the next one. Everybody talks about the greenhouse gas effect. I mean, it's a big concern. We talk about greenhouse gases. We talk about CO2. We talk about methane. We talk about nitrous oxide. And actually, one of the biggest greenhouse gases out there nobody talks about is water vapor, how much humidity there is in the air. Because this morning was fairly cool. Yesterday morning was a lot warmer, right? What changed between the two mornings? The humidity. When I drove down from Ames this morning, there was across the valley. There was all this fog in there and everything else because we were very, very cool. And so water vapor is really what controls a lot of our cooling at night and all of this. And it's really a big barrier to how much we cool and all of this. So all of this, you look at this, greenhouse gas effect is very simple. In fact, that these gases are in the atmosphere, solar radiation comes down through that. They prevent that solar radiation from coming in. And think how hot your car gets during the summer. The same thing we're doing with the earth, because that greenhouse gas is just like that window on your car. It's not letting that radiation get back out to space. Let's go to the next one. Here's CO2 exchanges, because that's We have some of the longest observatories in the world, in Mauna Loa. This is the CO2 record on there. You go all the way from the 1960s to the current time. And to put it in perspective for you, when I worked on my PhD at Iowa State, background CO2 levels were in the order of 325 parts per million. When I finished my career and we were doing some CO2 work and everything, we were at 400 parts per million. So in the course of my career, we went to 75 parts per million. So we've really changed that, and we see these different dynamics going on in all of this. So things are changing. And let's go to the next one. When we look at these changes, you have to realize that everybody says, well, you know, what role does agriculture play in this? What role does industry? Agriculture is about 12% of our greenhouse gas emissions, and it primarily is in the result of nitrous oxide. That's what comes from nitrogen fertilizer in a lot of this. Methane, a lot of that comes from manure handling, animals, and then CO2 is really what comes out of all of us, including animals and soil and everything else. So all of those are there. But agriculture has the potential of being a very large sequester of carbon. And so that's why there's so much interest in carbon markets, buying and selling carbon credits between industry and agriculture. Looking at those parts of that pie chart out there, industry is looking at ag and saying, can you offset some of our emissions by sequestering carbon within soil? And we can spend a whole nother hour just talking about the carbon market piece of this. That's where lawyers really get involved, Jonathan. Let's go to the next one. Here's what's changed over time. And I think it's important to look and say, all right, what's changing in our climate out there? This is not projected forward. This is what's occurred in the past. And basically, from the early part of the century to the late part of the century, you see that that blue area is where we've gotten wetter. Our annual precipitation has gone up. I know it's hard to convince you that the annual precipitation is going up because this morning they're talking about we're back in a drought. Winter precipitation, this Texas and everything is showing an increase in winter precipitation. We've shown a little bit of increase in winter precipitation. We don't get a lot there anyway. So, but the spring precipitation, we've gotten wetter in the springs. Summer precipitation has been a little variable, and fall precipitation we've increased. The bookends of our agricultural system, planting and harvesting, are in a systems in which we have increasing rainfall. So we have disruptions in planting, we have disruptions in harvest, and all of this. So that's kind of the trend, and that goes to the next one. Here's what's really changing within this. Not only is the annual amounts going up, the intensity of the storms are changing as well. And this is probably of more concern to us. You look over time is that we have more and more extreme events. And just go to the next one because I'll draw it down to an Iowa example now. Extreme events, this is days above 2 inches, and that you can think, well, 2 inches is not hardly anything. Well, in climatology terms, 2 inches is an extreme event in a given day. And you can see that what we've done in the last decades is that we've gotten more and more of these events that are in excess of 2 inches per day. And you see this across all the Midwest. So our rain, we're getting more rain, but we're getting more of that rain in higher totals in a given event. And so we change all of these different dynamics. We go long periods without rain, and then we get very heavy rainfall events as well. Kentucky being that example of recently we had some other parts. Iowa's had some real parts. So we've had 12 inches in a day in parts of Iowa over recent history as well. And we just can't absorb that much water. It's going to run off as well. So let's go to the next one. Here's just that map across the whole United States. There's nobody other than Hawaii that's actually showing a decrease in extreme events. Everybody else in the last decades. The biggest one that's showing that is the Northeast United States. And that's really concerning to a lot of us is that precipitation events are increasing in intensity, in the Northeast. And we have so much pavement there. We're a lot of urban area. a lot of flash flooding going on. So how do we look at urban planning going into the future in terms of how do we handle these extreme events from that standpoint? Let's go to the next one. But, you know, let's look into the future now. And this is to the year of 2075. This is on the trajectory that we're at with CO2 right now, composite of lots of climate models. If you look at the whole northern hemisphere, North America, winter, we're expecting an increase in precipitation. Spring, we're expecting an increase in precipitation. What's concerning to a lot of us is our long-term projections is that lower left graph, is that our summer precipitation is decreasing. Summer precipitation already showing a tendency to not only decrease but also become more variable. You think about the implications of this for agriculture, is that we've built our agricultural systems on reliable summer rainfall. And summer rainfall is becoming less reliable. If you go and look at the drought monitor maps, you can see that Iowa this next week will explode in terms of the amount of state that's covered by drought. And we expect that to intensify the rest of the year because now we're in a period of critical water needs. Corn, soybeans, this is their highest water use period. They dependent upon what's in that soil water, soil moisture profile. And if it doesn't rain, we end up with a lot of stress and we end up with low yields. So we expect the Chicago Board of Trade also to start showing increased prices as well. I could never be in trade on the market because I knew what was going on. So I was prohibited from trading. And then fall, as we said, even we show this in the record, but showing in projection, fall is going to become wetter. So our bookends of the season are in long term are going to remain what we've seen in the signal as well. Let's go to the next one. Here's temperature. Temperatures across the United States, this is again like that precipitation map. We're looking at the early part of the century versus the latter part of the century. Desert Southwest has gotten hotter. That doesn't surprise anybody. There's a lot more 100-degree days in Phoenix now than there was a long time ago. The only place that really cool was the Southeast. Southeast actually cooled a little bit, drove everybody crazy in terms of trying to figure out that. In the Midwest, actually, a little bit neutral, but cooled a little bit as we went on, and you see the different piece. But we all warmed. And what's interesting is the pattern of that warming. Let's go to the next one. Because we expect when we talk about global warming and we talk about these warming temperatures is that everything is going up. But in reality, maximums have been going down. Minimums are going up. So there's actually a warming because it's just basically mathematics. We're warming because we've gotten those two temperatures together, but they're not all going up at the same rate. So we actually, and this year, we were talking about the fact, how many 90-degree days have we had? Well, we've had more 90-degree days this summer than we typically have, but not atypical. Don't think anybody in here remembers the 1930s very well. But if you look back in the climatological record of the 1930s, we had a lot of temperatures across Iowa that were in excess of 105 to 110 degrees throughout a good number of days during the summer. So I want to go back and look at temperature records. I just go back and look at 1934 and 35 or 36 in terms of those temperatures as well. So, and we could come back to that type of extreme again as well. So we see that going on in the pattern. Let's go to the next one. Here's the other thing is changing. This is frost-free days. Our seasons are getting actually longer. The upper Midwest, we're about 9 days longer in terms of the period from between last frost and first frost. And then Desert Southwest, almost 3 weeks longer in these dynamics. But that doesn't say that we can move a plant from Georgia that grows during that type of environment and put it into Iowa, because we still have the probability of having frost into May. So even though the frost-free season is getting a little longer, you can still end up with these periods of frost that will kill plants and things like this. So you look at all these different dynamics. All I'm saying is that weather remains variable and slightly unpredictable at times. So let's go to the next one. Here's some projections and key variables. Frost-free length is going to go up on the whole U.S. The number of consecutive dry days is going to increase, particularly across Texas, the Southwest. So that means that we're going to have a long period between rainfall events in this area. Hot nights are expected to increase. We have spent a lot of time looking at hot nights. I'll explain why that's important, but it's important for us as humans. It's important for livestock, and it's important for crops as well. So let's go to the next one. I'm going to now talk about the impacts on crops, because this gets to the heart of a lot of this. Let's go to the next one. I'm going to start off by showing maybe busting some myths that everybody thinks about, is that these are temperature responses, and the first one on the left is corn. Corn has a very high optimum temperature range during the vegetative period. Contrary to belief, the corn really likes it much cooler during the grain filling period. And just think about this for a little bit, is that you look at that purple band out there, is that the optimum temperature for corn is about 72, 73 degrees during that grain filling period. And so when we get these really hot temperatures, it really does influence our ability to fill grain as well. Soybeans are a lot more tolerant than corn, surprisingly. That's why that farmer adage that grain is made in August and soybeans holds true, because of the temperature response on this as well. And so you look at these different temperature pieces. We spent a lot of time looking at this, showing these different dynamics and how crops are responding to the different temperature regimes as well. But it's just an idea that we need to understand that what crops are subjected to during their whole life cycle as it relative to the climate patterns that's out there. This is the heart of agricultural climatology. So let's go to the next one. I'll give you some definitions, because I spent a lot of time looking at genetic potential. What could a crop really produce versus what it actually produces? And I've made a whole piece of this. If you look at that bar on the left, that's the genetic potential of corn is roughly 600 bushels per acre. The actual yields that we get are somewhere in the order of 178 to 180 on the national average and everything. So 600 minus 180, you have 420 bushels that is lost out there in terms of genetic potential out there. And so why are we losing that? And so we spent a lot of time saying, what prevents us from achieving genetic potential? You know, where's weather fitting into that? Where's management fit into that? Let's go to the next one. I spent a lot of time looking at this. This is an analysis we did across the three states, Kentucky, Iowa, and Nebraska. What we did is this, each one of those data points represents 40 years of county level data. So we selected counties out of each of those states. We looked at it relative to an index that the National Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, has. It's called the NCCPI, National Crop Commodity Productivity Index. It really says what's the quality of the soil that county represents. Zero is a parking lot. One is a really high quality soil. It only goes from zero to one. And so you look at this, and basically you say, well, the higher the quality of the soil, the higher the average county yield. In all of this, except for Nebraska. And you say, well, what's wrong with Nebraska? There's a lot of things wrong with Nebraska, but what we did in Nebraska is we only picked irrigated counties. So if you can control the water, the quality of the soil doesn't mean anything to you. So if you can manage the weather, you are not dependent upon what soil you're really producing it on. And let's go to the next one. We did the same thing with corn across that. Let's go to the next one. This is the NCCPI across the Midwest, across the Corn Belt. And, you know, we're blessed in Iowa because we have those highest quality soils. And so you get into Kentucky, we have really low quality soils. That's why we see a lot of those different pieces out there. We're moving that Corn Belt into the North Dakota and South Dakota into lower quality soils. So we see a lot more variation from year to year in all of this. Let's go to the next one. But here's our limitations to yield. The number one limitation to crop productivity is water, and then nutrients, then temperature, soil radiation, and then pests, weeds, insects, and diseases. Water is our primary deterrent. It really is about 40% of the yield loss every year is due to water dynamics and not raining at the right time, stress during either beginning or end of the season as well. And so when we still look at this, let's go to the next one. What we went back and we looked at these, how genetic potential versus what we were actually getting out there. And on corn and soybeans, here's what we begin to see as the major deterrents to productivity over time. Maximum July temperatures. The hotter it is in July, the lower the average county yield because it really disrupts pollination. And we saw a lot of this. You drive around and you see a lot of tassels really have not emerged above the top of that canopy very well. And I think a lot of that's due to the water stress that we had. High temperatures, pollen is very sensitive to high temperature. Minimum August temperatures actually was a major deterrent because the warmer it is at night during August, the lower the yields, because that plant is not very efficient in taking and converting solar radiation into photosynthesis and then putting that into grain, starch, protein, whatever else we put it into. And so the warmer it is at night, what we see is that we are not as efficient in that whole photosynthetic process because we just respire everything out. If you grew up without air conditioning in your house and it was hot during the summer night, what was it like? It was brutal, right? Let's be honest. You know, you really could not sleep well at night because you need to cool down at night. Plants need to cool down at night. Livestock needs to cool down. We have our biggest mortalities in livestock because of high temperatures at night during periods of time. And then obviously July, August rainfall is out there. Winter wheat, we did analysis across the whole wheat belt, and it's really about rainfall during that grain filling period. Temperatures are, it's growing during a time in which we don't have those really high temperatures. We might have a little frost damage, but high temperatures are rarely impacting that. It's all about the water dynamics. Let's go to the next one. This is just a map of available soil water across the field because it's that availability of soil water that really determines yield maps. When we start looking at farmers' analysis of their yield maps that come off their combine, we find those are related to how much water is available within that soil profile. So we can look and say, if it's not raining and we've got poor soil out there, we're going to end up that. And if you drive around a lot of the fields over the next week or so, you can see those really poor parts of those fields because that corn will be gray, it'll be spiked, and it'll be about 2 feet shorter than the rest of the crop out there. Let's go to the next one. We did some long-term projections in this of climate variables going forward in different areas because I'm going to point out what's going to happen across. Go to the next one. So we took all these yield maps and looked at across and said, all right, so what's going to happen by 2075 across the Corn Belt? And the darker the color in here, the bigger the yield gap. We're not going to have profitable yields across the lower part of Illinois. We're talking about yields projected that could be in less than 120 bushels per acre. It takes almost 180 to 200 bushels an acre to make profitability right now. It says that we may have to shift the Corn Belt across that. We see, I mean, we can expand that into Kentucky and everything else. There'll be enough to still make bourbon. We're going to have to be selective in how we think about the use of that crop. Let's put it that way. And so you see all these different projections going forward is expecting that on a worldwide basis, how fragile our agricultural system is and how we need to be looking at this. Let's go to the next one. So you just kind of summarize all of this from a standpoint that crops, you know, how they, what are they sensitive to, what all these different things. Corn, these high nighttime temperatures have a much bigger impact than what people thought. Soybeans, water stress, high temperatures, it's even influences soybean production. Wheat and small grains is extreme events. Frost is an extreme event. Water stress, rice. Rice is interesting. I'll use rice as an example because we find out that pollination is very, and rice is very sensitive to high temperatures. And the way they found to combat that is the breeders observed that rice varieties that pollinated early in the day, when the temperatures are cooler, think about how temperature responds during the day, had much better grain set than those that pollinated during the heat of the day. And so they were selecting varieties that just shifted their pollination patterns. A lot of this about is just observation. How do you begin to think about these different pieces of this? Cotton. Cotton is an example because cotton, we don't think about this very much, but the higher temperatures during the boll fit and fiber development changes the length of fiber. So we change the quality of that cotton crop by the temperatures as well. Let's see. And then fruit trees is chilling requirements that we talked about for cherries. High temperatures during fruit development also lead to poor quality. I wanted to write a report for USDA, but they wouldn't let me. In terms that I wanted to title it High Temperature Mushy Apples. But because we see those really poor quality apples as a result of when we have high temperatures, but they didn't, they thought that was too frivolous. But now I can do that. But let's go to the next one. I'm going to give you an example because there's another piece of this, and this is in terms of pest. And it's this is one of our favorite bugs. It's not everybody's favorite bug, but it's a pretty interesting bug. It's the stink bug and everything. And, you know, and so let's go to the next one. I'll give you, this is an invasive insect. Let's just go to the next one. Memorize this graph, okay? This is like an eye test. Which is going to be better, A, B, or C? Okay, so this is... this is the current distribution of the stink bug. And then we go forward by 2050 using some of this. You see that there's a lot of change in that period. We're moving the stink bug into Canada and everything else. Let's go to the next one. This is now at the end of the century. We've warmed up so much that the stink bug is no longer a problem in Florida and the Southeast, because we've just shifted the range of all of this. And we've done this with Palmer amaranth, that herbicide resistant weed, looking at this distribution across the Midwest as well. And you see all these different pieces. Let's go to the next one. I'll talk just a little bit about the implications is that we do have increasing variation in our climate. It's a misnomer to me to say that we're in a period of global warming. Everybody just expects this nice trajectory going up there. It's not going to happen that way. It's going to be extremely variable. We built a concept that we call genetics by environment by management. It's basically management is what producers do. And because we're trying to look at how they optimize their genetics. So we work with them on how they can select management options to overcome the weather variation that's out there. It's going to alter insects, but we do have opportunities in agriculture to look at this. So bottom line is that we have some real potential in a lot of different cases. And that's the last one. Please go to the next. Here's my contact information. The reason I give you this is that we cover a lot of material in a short period of time. And generally about 2 days later, you have a question. Go, gee, now I wish I'd asked him that. Well, you have my email address in there, and you also have my cell phone. if I don't answer, it's because I think you're probably trying to sell me extended warranty for my car or life insurance or a new Medicare plan or something like that. So so anyway, I'll entertain some questions. I know it's right up at time, but. Sure.
General, how much of resilience or adaptation is going to come from genetically modified crops versus management of soil and irrigation?
For the geneticist's perspective, 100% will come from genetics. From everybody else, that's more realistic. We think probably 70 to 80% is going to come through management improved technologies. That's where adaptation is, that we've reached some of our limits. I mean, genetic potential has been 600. So it's a matter of how do we capture that? And that really comes from the management perspective. Although, I'll give you one example, is drought tolerant corn. You know, we've been pretty well on drought tolerant corn of stabilizing yields. However, when I asked geneticists, what's their mechanism of drought tolerance? You know, is it improved capability of withstanding drought? Is it better recovery? They go, we don't know. So I think there's a lot of places. And so that's why we built the G by E by M complex, is to really bring all this together and start looking at it, saying, where do we have capabilities with genetics and where do we have capabilities with management and how do we best optimize both of those? It's not one or the other. It's a combination of a system.
I had no idea that there was so much science behind system, but you touched on the chase. What's the implication for what price of a coffee will be in 20 years?
Price of a pound of coffee in 20 years from now? It's probably going to be at least double. Because we see a couple things happen in coffee plantations. One is the changing climate. But the other piece, and that's why I threw out the pest piece, is we're seeing a lot of diseases come in to some of the plantations that we don't quite understand the mechanisms of what's triggering those diseases. And even on a lot of our crops, about 40% of our yield loss can be due to pests and diseases. So that's going to drive the price as well. And coffee, because it is a perennial crop, it's very subjective. It takes a long time to move coffee plantations and get them established. But, you know, I don't think anything is going to come down in price over the next 20 years. You can bank on that as well. Jonathan.
Assuming that human activity is contributing to global warming, do you think we've passed the point of no return?
No. I'll be quite honest. I don't think we've passed the point of no return. And the reason I say that is so flippantly or authoritatively is that I have no idea, but, you know, I always said, you know, it's better to answer with complete, confidence and then people accept the answer. But, you know, in reality, I should have been a lawyer, right, John? is that, you look at this, human activity is interplaced on top of a lot of climate cycles. And we as humans have to accept certain responsibilities for the degree that we're at. But you also look and you look long-term trends. We're seeing some shifts in solar radiation output. I'll give you one quick example on this. Back in the 1700s, the impact of solar radiation, because we were in a period of reduced solar output, it was the year without summer. Across Europe and everything. That's actually when a lot of the books like Dracula were written, a lot of those really scary books, because the authors had a contest because they couldn't meet on the sidewalk cafes. And so they spent time in their home writing, seeing who could write the scariest damn book out there. And so that's why that a lot of that's occurring. And so I think you've got these cycles as well. I mean, we could have a reduction in solar input that would just completely offset all of the human activity in a heartbeat. Well, not a heartbeat, but climatologically in a heartbeat. So, yes, sir.
Because you mentioned how pests follow, but did I really? Should I buy a present day glacier in Canada, knowing that in 40 years that's going to be very fertile soil and those fall on top of it?
Yeah, I mean, land is a good investment no matter where you buy it. You know, I'm not sure that I'd buy on the edge of a glacier yet. I mean, I might put my money in still Iowa, good prime Iowa soil.
As,
but.
As I understand it, Country County, Iowa, in 2035, I believe Iowa State predicts it will be like someplace in Oklahoma.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Well, gee, to me, that's pretty different.
Well, yeah, if we look at some of the county, and this is one of my reasons of showing you that map, so where we're going to change productivity, is that corn and soybeans will become too risky, but what do we do in an agriculture enterprise in the lower two tiers, even Guthrie County, and looking at different alternative systems? I can put different crops in there that make you money. And so, you know, if you want, think about these different dynamics, it really becomes a matter of how do we strategize. That's what ag climatology has always been about, is how do we match crops to locations.
But, I mean, you're saying you can give me different.
Sure.
That will be in demand. I mean, corn and soybean are edible, you know, they contribute to the food chain. I grow tobacco.
No, I wouldn't be growing tobacco.
But what takes the place of corn and soybean?
There's a lot of oilseed crops. I mean, you got canola, you got carinata, you got, and there's a lot.
There's oil, but what about protein?
Protein, you can get protein out of canola. Actually, canola oilseed meal is a better protein source for hogs than is soybean meal. That's your trivia for the day. So, all right.
Jerry had some interesting things to say about Nebraska. I heard that on the night before, a little bighorn, when Custer called all of his troops together, he said, "I've got some bad news and I've got some good news. Bad news is we're surrounded by hostile forces, and tomorrow they're going to slaughter all of us, including the horses we rode in on." And a private in the front row says, "Well, Custer, what's good news after that?" And he responds, "We don't have to go back home across Nebraska." You may have looked at our intended speaker for this morning and thought, we're going to get together on a Friday morning at 7 o'clock in the morning and talk about dirt. That can't possibly be interesting, right? Well, it was, Jerry. And as Wade mentioned at the outset, you come to Breakfast Club and you learn something every time. And today was no exception. It was remarkable. I mean, how you made dirt interesting is pretty interesting to me. And we really appreciate it. There is, as they say, a long game and a short game. Short game is usually between elections, you know, and you do all kinds of things politically in the short term. The long game is what Jerry was talking about this morning. And frankly, I can make a transition on that to the cause of civil equality for LGBT community. We can play the short game from one election to the next, one up or down, or we can play the long game, and we can see the kind of progress that we have made over the course of the last 50 years, for example. And Jerry certainly makes the point that the long game is where we need to be staying focused, if we're going to be responsible stewards. Okay. We have a number of interesting, upcoming speakers that you will not want to miss. In September, will be Congresswoman Cindy Axne. In October will be Dana Carden. He's the former KCCI Assistant News Director. And he has been involved in a number of journalistic awards. In November, is a U.S. Senate candidate, Mike Franken, who won the Democratic nomination to run against, Charles, Grassley. In December is Reverend, Rushing Kimball. He's the associate pastor at Plymouth, Church. In January, it's Matt Sinovic, who is the executive director of Progress Iowa, a statewide organization that focuses on research, education, and advocacy. It should be fascinating. February is to be determined. And March is going to be Mark Stringer, who is the executive director of ACLU of Iowa, used to be the pastor at First Unitarian Church. He's spoken to us on previous occasions and has been among the best speakers that we have had, and you won't want to miss his presentation. In April is Frank Marasco, the Polk County Sheriff. You won't want to miss that one either. And we want to invite anyone who has some ideas about potential speakers to let us know, and we'll find some kind of access to them and see if we can get them on board to speak to the Breakfast Club. And we have February still to fill, so be thinking about a potential speaker and let us know whatever that is. And with that, we will stand adjourned, and I want to thank you for being at Breakfast Club this week. Thank you.